Morning. So this weekend was a big one for Ella. The Homestead Showcase, which is like, I guess, the biggest show choir event in the country, they're saying now. As part of that, we had parent volunteer hours, so read those fine print carefully when you sign up for your kids to do activities. Got to go on Friday night and be part of just kind of seeing what happened, and it was amazing how many people were there. If Beth looked a little tired today, it's because she had to go pick Ella up at a very unholy hour. I was asleep. I think I just grunted over at 3 a.m., so that's what time she had to be picked up this morning. But I'm at Homestead, and that's the high school I went to. It's a little different than when I was there, but still, it's the high school I went to. And I'm walking through the halls, and I'm looking at these high school students that look so little to me and so young, which, again, probably is how I look to many of you, so young, especially after I trimmed off my beard there. Hopefully, you guys have a better reaction than my kids did. I came out of the bathroom yesterday, and Ava said, I can't look at you. Can't do it. Don't know who you are anymore. But I'm at Homestead. I'm at the school, and it brings up memories of the past and kind of walking through the halls that I did so many years ago. And as I was doing that, and I was thinking about the sermon today, I remembered how every year in school, around Halloween, we would read the same stories by the same author. It's funny because in school, I think we're not allowed to do a lot of the ghoulish horror type stories, but there's one author that we read every year. It's Edgar Allan Poe. And it's not just something I did for me. My kids still read it every year around that time. It's the story of the Telltale Heart. It's the story of the Raven. And it's funny to me, there's a little bit of irony because if the students really understand what they're reading, if they really take the story to heart, then in reality, that story is far more horrifying than much of what they might have read otherwise. They didn't really tame it down because, if we're honest, these stories of our own sin and our own guilt and how we cope with that, they're more horrifying than any monster, than any villain. This idea of how do we live with the guilt and the sin that we have is pretty terrifying, especially if we don't have Christ. And this morning, we're going to look a little bit differently than we did last week. Last week, we looked at Joseph and how he healed himself. Well, he was healed, not healed himself. God healed him. But how he overcame the trauma of his past events and found peace. Today we're going to look at the other side of the coin, the other side of the story, and we're going to look at the brothers and how they didn't find peace, how they struggled and wrestled with their guilt and with their sin, knowing what they'd done to their brother. We're going to look at how that affected them throughout and how that affected them here at this pivotal moment in their story. How it clouded their judgment. How it made things difficult. We're going to learn a little bit about ourselves and how we can learn from their example. How do we move on? Because the Bible is very clear. It's easy for us to get hard on Joseph's brothers here for the things that they'd done. But the truth is, we've all sinned. We've all fallen short of the glory of God. None of us are blameless. And so we're all going to deal with guilt. We're all going to live through shame. And how we respond to that is very important. So there's a lot going on in our story, and I didn't want to have Beth read three chapters from the lectern today. So I'm going to catch us up on where we are. Last week, we saw how Joseph was now second in command in Egypt, answering only to Pharaoh. We saw how he's married and he has at least two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, firstborn too. His plan has not only been successful, and we can't take that for granted. Few of us would have the skills needed to succeed in a public works plan like this. How do you convince the farmers in the good years to give up some of their grain to store away? How do you build these new structures to store the grain? There's a lot going on. But Joseph is successful. He's done a great job. And now the years of famine have begun, which has only confirmed that Joseph, the dreams were correct. His interpretation was correct. And you could imagine today, if we knew somebody who could tell the future and prepare for it, that would be pretty valuable. And for Pharaoh, Joseph has proven himself immensely valuable. There's no waiting for the shoe drop. Everything has been confirmed. And now people from all over the region are coming into Egypt hungry and desperate, and they're using almost all of their treasure, their resources, to buy grain. And Joseph is the man who sits and oversees this. It's one of the biggest wealth transfers in history. As all of these neighboring regions are bringing bags of silver and gold to buy grain that used to be very, very cheap. It was in abundance, but now it's desperate, and they're doing this to save their lives. We see in chapter 42, verses 1 and 2, when Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you keep looking at each other?" He continued, "I have heard there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die." It's desperate. The famine is bad. And Jacob sends his sons, but not all of his sons. See, he has one new favorite. It's Benjamin. If we remember back to the beginning of our series, Joseph is the favorite because Joseph is the oldest son born to his favorite wife. And that wife dies in childbirth, having Benjamin. So Benjamin and Joseph are the only full brothers they have of each other. Where the other brothers to Leah had more children, quite a few children, but Rachel only had a few, the two. As you can imagine, Joseph and Benjamin were beloved by Jacob. And Joseph is now gone, and it's assumed that he's been torn apart by wild animals because that's the story the brothers shared after their betrayal. And so when it's time to go buy grain, when it's time to send the brothers, the sons of Jacob, to Egypt, he says, "You all go, the 10 of you, but Benjamin is staying with me." And the brothers arrive, and they don't recognize Joseph because, again, they thought Joseph was dead. Now he is dressed like an Egyptian, and he is raised up, and while everyone else is gaunt and pale and struggling, he looks beautiful. He's well fed. He's in the appearance of the Egyptians. He's royalty now. But Joseph recognizes his brothers, and through a little bit of trickery, a little bit of testing, he doesn't reveal himself, and he even uses a translator so that while he can understand everything his brothers are saying, they don't always know that. There's a YouTube channel that I kind of like. It's a very white guy who looks like me, and he goes into Chinese restaurants, and he acts kind of like he doesn't know what he's going on, but I think he's a professor of Cantonese and Mandarin, so he starts to listen, and he'll respond to what they're saying in Chinese and then order perfectly off the menu. And you see the look on the faces of the people who work in the restaurants there in Chinatown in New York or in Chicago and these other areas. And they're so startled and baffled because they thought when they spoke in their own language that no one could understand. And that's what's going on, is the brothers feel at peace to talk freely, and Joseph's listening. And Joseph tests them and says, "You're spies here to find our weaknesses so that you can invade us." And the brothers say, "No, no, no, that's not true." And then Joseph begins to ask questions to test them. He says, "Do you have a father?" And again, I'm sure that out of sincerity, Joseph wants to know how his father's doing. And he finds out his father's still alive. And then he asks, "Do you have a brother?" Because he sees that his closest brother is missing. And they say, "Yes, he's, for lack of a better word, he's our dad's favorite now. He was born to him in his old age. And you can't let him go and leave his side." So Joseph sells them grain. And he says, "Here's the deal. You're going to leave one of your brothers behind." And it becomes Simeon. He said, "I will release Simeon, the brother you leave behind, when you bring your youngest brother to me so that I know your story is true. And if you bring your youngest brother to me, I'll release the other. But until then, he is my prisoner." And he loads up their animals, their mules and donkeys, with bags of grain so that they can sustain not only themselves, but their families and their households and their father. And they go back with lots of grain to Egypt, enough to last a while. And as they stop at their first stop and they open up the bags, they see that in the bags of grain, all of the silver they used to buy the grain, and this is an immense amount of wealth, has been put back in the bags. And their reaction is pretty funny. Well, most of us would be like, "Wow, great." They are terrified that this is a sign, that this is God is doing something. They are about to be found out. Their guilt is about to be punished. So they go back and they tell their father of everything that happened. And their father says, "Absolutely not. I have already lost Joseph. Now I have lost Simeon. There is no way that I'm going to lose Benjamin too." And so time goes on, and it's a fairly significant amount of time. Remember, there are many years of famine that were part of this prediction. And so the famine continues. And like any famine, year number 5 is worse than year number 2. It's getting worse. There's fewer resources. Everyone is hungry and desperate, and they're back to the place where the bags of grain are empty, and they're hungry. And Jacob says, "Why don't you go back and buy more grain?" But the brothers remind him of what Joseph said. And there's some back and forth. And finally, in great protest, Jacob says, "Okay, I guess my son is gone too. I'll send Benjamin. But if we don't do this, we all die." And so they go down and he sends them with all of the silver to buy more grain plus all of the silver that was given back to them. And they get to Egypt. Joseph is very happy to see his brothers, emotional. But again, he tests his brothers. The brothers say, "We brought more silver because there was a mistake. Something happened." And Joseph's words are, "No, God has blessed you. I serve the same God you do. He's blessed you. That's yours. That silver had nothing to do with me." He has a meal with his brothers, and his brothers are a little put off by the fact that he perfectly sets them off by oldest to youngest. And then when he gets to Benjamin, Benjamin gets an extra large portion. And then when it's time for them to leave, Joseph again tests his brothers. He puts them in a difficult situation. He puts the money back in the bag, and this time he takes his divination cup. This is a tool that was used way back when. If you remember in the New Testament when Jesus has ascended to heaven, they're talking about picking another disciple, they cast lots. And so these are some of the tools that were used even by believers things that can make some of us in the modern church a little uncomfortable, to be able to say, okay, God, what are you doing? So it's a little bit like the magic eight ball, but instead of asking the magic eight ball, they're asking God, and then they would see what comes up in the cup. And it could be a tool or a source for God to use, but for Joseph, dreams were much more effective. So there's this divination cup, and it's a special, beautiful cup, and it's put in Benjamin's bag. And he sends them away, but then he sends his soldiers after them and accuses them of stealing his cup. And the brothers say, search our bags. We didn't steal it. It's a moment that reminds us a little bit of Laban's encounter with their father, Jacob, earlier. Way earlier in life. When Rachel had stolen the family idols. And each bag is searched, oldest to youngest, until they get to Benjamin and they see the cup taken out of the bag and everyone's heart is shattered. And that's where our passage was today. Joseph says, well, the rest of you can go. I'm just going to take Benjamin as my slave. Can you imagine? That's the worst case scenario for these brothers. And you see the brothers, they plead. And they say, you don't understand, this will kill our father. This will kill him. He will not survive losing Benjamin. And later then, and beyond what Beth read, the test is over and Joseph reveals himself. He sends away the other servants and it's very emotional. And we'll get there. But that's where we are in the story. First thing I want to look at this morning is we examine the brothers and how they wrestled with their sin and guilt. Is that for them and for us, our sin changes the way others see us. Genesis 44:12. Then the steward proceeded in searching, beginning with the oldest and then ending with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. A lot has changed in these years, and these brothers have changed in these years. But for Joseph, he doesn't know that. We can be kind of hard on Joseph for the what feels like deceitful behavior here. Why is he toying cat and mouse with his brothers? Why is he punishing them in this way, making them so uncomfortable? Especially when we see that earlier he already forgave them. He already came to peace that God had put him here. And even if you see his language throughout the passage to come, he says to his brothers when he reveals himself to be Joseph, he said, don't worry because it wasn't really this thing that you did to me. He said, this was God's work. He remembered the vision. He said, God did this so that I could save so many lives. So Joseph was at peace. Why would a man at peace toy with his brothers like this? Why wouldn't he simply embrace them from the beginning? Well, the reason for this is he knew their guilt. He saw what they were capable of. And Joseph didn't know how much they'd grown or changed. He didn't. And here was the perfect test. When it came time for them to realize, well, when they understood from the dream that Joseph believed that one day his brothers would bow down, when they knew that he was his favorite, their response was to murder him. They would not only save their own lives, but they would prosper their own lives by murdering Joseph. Would they do the same thing for Benjamin? Benjamin was all that had to be sacrificed for the other brothers to go home with treasure and bags full of grain. All they had to do was do to Benjamin what they had done to Joseph and they would be wealthier than they were. They would have all the food they needed. They would be able to go back to their father and say, look, yeah, maybe your favorite's gone, but one of us can be your new favorite. In jealousy, they had murdered, in their mind, in their eyes, their brother. They sent him to slavery. But there wasn't a huge difference. And they could sacrifice Benjamin to do the same. You see, sin changes the way others see us. Forgiveness and trust are different things. God calls us to be quick to forgiveness. But that doesn't mean that we put ourselves in the same position to be hurt in the same way, at least not right away. It doesn't mean that we go back to the abuser to be abused again. And the danger here is that there is a feedback loop. As we sin, or especially for a young man, young woman, child, as they sin, as they become labeled that way, as it changes the way that others see them. Have you ever met a kid that's been labeled a bad kid? Well, once that label of bad kid is on them, you begin to live up to the reputation. We saw this in Jacob. Before his name was changed to Israel, what did Jacob mean? It meant heel grabber. It meant deceiver and liar. And the more you're called a liar, the more you end up living up to that reputation and lying. And Joseph here is testing his brothers, but it has to happen that way for Joseph because he doesn't know if they've changed. He remembers the brothers that sold him into slavery. We've got to understand that when we sin against someone else, it changes the way they look at us. That's why in the Bible there's this concept, not only reconciliation, but restitution. This idea of how do I pay it back? How do I make things right again? And the beautiful thing is, well, you can do something one or two or more times, and it can put a label on us and it can give us a reputation. Eventually, if we do other things long enough, that reputation and that perception will change. The Super Bowl's today. And I remember years when the Bengals were a terrible football team. But today they're in the Super Bowl. And the first good game the Bengals had, I'm sure if you were to get on ESPN, or if you were to look in the newspaper at the articles, their first really good football game after being a terrible football team, those writing stories would say, well, this was an aberration. This was a lucky game. They're really not a very good football team, but they got lucky. They had a good game. You put two of those games together, and maybe it's luck and maybe not, but you begin to put together a winning season, and now you're no longer a bad football team. You get to the Super Bowl, and you're potentially a championship football team. And so if you don't like the labels that your sin has put on you, if you're the black sheep of the family, if you're known by that one bad thing you did that one time, the good news is if you are patient and you are steadfast and you don't let that define you, it can change just like it did for Joseph and his brothers. Joseph tested his brothers, but then he saw that things had changed. Where before they were willing to sacrifice their brother for their benefit, now they were willing to sacrifice themselves for their brother. The second thing that happens is that sin lowers our expectations. Verse 16, What can we say to my Lord? Judah replied. What can we say? How can we prove our innocence? God has uncovered your servant's guilt. We are now my Lord's slaves. We ourselves and the one who was found to have the cup. Earlier, and this is some time ago in chapter 42, they say a similar thing. This is after they found the gold. They said to one another, surely we are being punished because of our brother. We saw how dissatisfied he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we would not listen. That's why this distress has come on us. And it's a weird thing to say when you have a windfall of money brought in your lap that now this is distress brought on you because of the terrible thing you did in your past. Reuben replied, didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy? But you wouldn't listen. Now we must give an accounting for his blood. They did not realize that Joseph could understand them. Again, this is when he was listening, since he was using an interpreter. When we have guilt and shame in our life, when we haven't learned to live under grace yet, there's an expectation always that the shoe is going to drop, that this might be punishment for what I have done. It was weeks ago we talked about some of the different scammers, and we talked about the Elizabeth Holmes with Theranos. But there are many examples of that. There's the Bernie Madoffs in this world. And what's funny that people don't realize is that they say, how could their behavior be so self-destructive? How could they do that? Why didn't they get out? Well, the truth is, from day one, in almost every one of those circumstances, they knew that this was going to crash and burn. They knew that they would be found out. They were just surprised by how long it took. I mean, every one of those is a Bonnie and Clyde situation where they know it ends with the car going off the cliff. And if you are stuck in that place where you know that the end of this is disaster, that you will be found out, and it's just a matter of time, when every morning you wake up and today could be the day that my sin finds me out, today could be the day that my boss realizes I have no idea what I'm doing. Today could be the day that my wife finds out, fill in the blank. Today could be the day that whatever, my sin, it's exposed. Today could be the day of my judgment. If that's our mindset, it lowers our expectation to the point where we begin to understand why there are so many around us in our world that live lives that are so self-destructive. Because that's the inevitable end. I've witnessed Christ to quite a few people in my life. And at one point, it was a coworker many years ago. We had a great conversation, and I thought she was quite receptive. And then she said, you know what, I'd like you to talk to my daughter about that. She said, I've done too many things, and there's no way that I could ever be saved or a Christian. But I'd really like that for my daughter. What a sad state of affairs. See, I believe that's true, but it couldn't be true for me. Because you don't understand what I've done. You don't understand the stain on my soul. And I didn't know her full story. Didn't fully understand what it was. But the good news of the gospel, the beauty of the gospel, is that there is no sin too great for God's grace to cover. So sin, it lowers our expectation. It makes us prepared for disaster. And again, for those of us, and again, I'd like to believe I'm one who lives under grace. For those of us who've lived under grace, who've lived in Christian community for a long time, this idea of waking up every morning prepared for the shoe to drop, that sounds exhausting. But it's where the brothers were, and it meant that they couldn't even look at a good thing as a good thing. They had to analyze it. They had to be paranoid about it. I can only imagine winning the lottery and saying, oh my gosh, now God's really got it out for me. Getting an inheritance. Oh no, this is when it all falls apart. Good news isn't even good news when we're living under the pressure of guilt and sin. And Edgar Allan Poe knew this. This is why we talk about the horror of his stories. It's not that there's some great monster. It's that in both cases, it was the fear of being found out. The fear of not being enough. So again, it not only changes the way people see us, it lowers our expectations. It puts us in that pattern of self-destructive behavior. And then finally, our sin projects itself onto others. We'll read verse 24, but it really we'll talk about how it alludes back to other events. When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him what my Lord had said. Then our father said, go back and buy a little more food. But we said, we cannot go down, only if our youngest brother is with us, we will go. We cannot see this man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. When we get into this cycle, something really terrible and destructive happens in our relationships. And that is we begin to assume the guilt we have upon others. We begin to look at what we've done and we assume that everyone else would treat us the same way. Because, right, we're only human after all. One of the questions that's very popular on an HR hiring test. The test has a lot of different questions to try and build the character and quality of a candidate. But one of them, it'll say, please rate, or you know, maybe 1 to 4. How many people do you think steal from the office? And 1 will be like, no one steals, or 0. And then maybe a few people steal, most people steal, or everybody steals. And the idea of that question is if they circle, well, everybody steals from the office, the reason they believe everybody steals from the office is that they would if they had the chance. If they believe most people steal from the office, it's probably a good chance that they would if they had a chance. But if somebody's like, well, nobody would steal from the office, who would do that? That's crazy. Why would you steal the petty cash? That's a terrible idea. There's a good chance that because they couldn't put themselves in that position. But if we are living with guilt and with sin, if we haven't resolved that within us, then the worst of ourselves we will project and assume from others. I really think it's almost the entire political conversation these days. Because it seems like in politics, one side only accuses the other side of the thing that they're doing. So if they say, I think they're doing this over there, it's because they know that they're doing it themselves. Both sides are cheating. But it's projection. And it's a part of the wages and the death that comes with sin. I see this in couples I've counseled. If one couple is accusing the other of cheating, sometimes it's because they've seen evidence and signs of that, but other times it's actually their own insecurity about their own behavior that they're projecting onto the one they love. And the brothers were this way. In fact, it was interesting to see as they're talking to their father in the previous passage, they're accusing Joseph as the ruler of Egypt here of doing the things that they had themselves done. And it isolates us. So sin isolates us in the way that others look at us, but it also isolates us in the way that we see others. So how do we overcome this? What's our way forward? Because again, this is not a hypothetical. The Bible makes it very clear, our human experience makes it very clear that we have all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. None of us is exempt from this. We've all gossiped. We've all said something behind somebody's back. We've all hurt deeply someone we've loved. I heard a comedian once say, he said, people say don't gossip. But he's like, no, I like to gossip. He said, the rule is don't say bad things about people behind their back and let them find out about it. And sometimes in the church, I think maybe that's what we do. It's like, well, no, gossip's bad if they find out. But they find out. We do selfish things. We do foolish things. Sometimes it's sins that we meant to commit and we were active in it. Other times we hurt people close to us and we sin and we didn't even mean to. It was because we let the ball down. We forgot. It's because we were careless or selfish. So we all deal with this. Hopefully most of you haven't tried to sell a sibling into slavery. I hope not. We all deal with this. And we have a little bit more in the manual than Joseph's brothers did. I mean, Joseph's brothers had the oral tradition from their father, but we get to look a little forward to the life of Jesus. And the way that we can handle it as we go to the foot of the cross. There is no sin, there is no guilt, there is no shame that cannot be covered by the blood of Jesus. And it was that one-time act, that once-and-for-all act on the cross that covers every sin. All we need to do is ask. Now, when Jesus forgives us, it doesn't mean that we don't still have work to do to make restitution to our brother. In fact, there are multiple passages in Scripture that say if you're going to go worship and you still have a problem with your brother or your sister in Christ, with somebody who's in your community with you, he said, leave your gift by the altar. You can come back for that, but go and make things right first. See, we need to be quick to forgive, but we also need to be quick to ask forgiveness. We need to be quick to say, you know what? I really messed up. I'm sorry. That's the oil that keeps community lubricated and moving, keeps the engine from seizing up. We've got to be quick to offer and quick to ask. And we're going to learn more about it in the coming weeks, but Joseph's story, I think, echoes that of the story of the parable that Jesus gives of the unmerciful servant. See, the brothers have a hard time receiving that forgiveness. And they have a hard time extending it further. And we'll get into that. But as we forgive, Jesus said, we are forgiven. And that parable for me is one of the most terrifying that I've read. Because I'd like to believe that forgiveness is just one-sided, that I get forgiveness. But Jesus says that our ability to receive forgiveness, to be forgiven, is dependent upon our ability to give it to others. And if I was going to tell you, church, the greatest hindrance I've seen in any church, not just ours, is bitterness. See, we can't really be in community with each other if we're holding grudges against others. And it doesn't even have to be somebody in this room. If you are mad at your parents, if you're mad at your grandparents, if you're mad at your kids, your grandkids, if there is someone that has a bitter root in your heart, in your life, if forgiveness hasn't flown freely there, it becomes like a blood clot in the heart.
It doesn't just stop at that. It gives us a hardened heart. It makes it difficult for us to give those in the church, those that we really want to extend it to. There's no room for it. And again, if there was one thing that any church could work on, it's if we examined our heart for forgiveness. Is there anyone I need to ask forgiveness of? And is there anyone I need to extend it to? Because the alternative is this. If we don't do that, we end up stuck in a place where others see us as the worst thing that we've done. We end up stuck in a place where our expectations are waiting at any time for God's judgment to fall upon us. We are like Bonnie and Clyde. We know how the story ends, and it's the car over the cliff. And we project our sin onto others, where we begin to accuse others of the things that we ourselves are guilty of. So I encourage you today, no matter how hard it is, to follow the example of Joseph and to forgive. Worship team, if you could come forward.